This recording is a production of Anabaptist Financial. More recordings are available on our website at www.afweb.org under the Resources menu or by calling 800-653-9817. This presentation was recorded at an employees seminar held on March 18, 2026 in Millersburg, Ohio.
What does it take to be a team player? Let's start by looking at part of a help wanted ad that I lifted from Plain News. It says, an ideal candidate communicates clearly, pays attention to detail, manages time well, and is a team player. So we all know that being a team player is a good thing, but let's say you were interested in this job. How do you know whether you are a team player or not? If you go to Google and search book about being a team player, the first result will be this book by Patrick Lencioni, The Ideal Team Player, How to Recognize and Cultivate the Three Essential Virtues. That's a fine book, but like most books on teamwork, it's a leader-centric viewpoint. It follows a CEO around as he tries to put together a good team, gets how to get his team to work together better. My approach today is different. I'm actually not sure that it's the leader's job to make teamwork happen. I think it's primarily my job and your job, the individual team members. I think it's our job to make teamwork happen. I think teamwork starts with individual team players, individual team members. Many of the obstacles to teamwork are things we need to overcome individually before we can overcome them as a team. So what does it take to be a team player? Well, it takes four things. Now, I know there are many qualities of a team player, but I'm suggesting these are the four main elements, and we're going to talk about them one by one. Character is the first one, and then followership, and then collaboration, and then competence. So let's start with character, the first element of a team player. This is who we are inside, our virtues and our vices, our attitudes. I'm going to show you a few headlines. I'm going to read to you a few headlines from ads published nearly 100 years ago. These ads are all from the same company selling the same product. And can you guess what product the ads were selling? So this one that I'm showing you here is from a 1928 issue of the Saturday Evening Post. And the headline is, "They talk about you behind your back." Other headlines from this campaign, from this ad campaign, were, "Could I be happy with him in spite of that?" And, "To those who are married, suspect yourself first." And, "She was losing him, and she didn't know why." And this last one, "Till breath do us part." So these headlines were from Listerine advertisements. Listerine has started out as an antiseptic, but the company wanted to sell more of their products, so they started marketing it as a mouthwash. And after an unnerving headline like this one, the ads would go on to say, "Don't fool yourself, since halitosis is the medical term for bad breath, since halitosis never announces itself to the victim, you simply cannot know when you have it. No matter how charming you may be or how fond of you your friends are, you cannot expect them to put up with halitosis forever. They may be nice to you, but it is an effort." So those headlines, those ads make us smile, but actually they make a good point. We hesitate to tell someone that they have bad breath. So if I have bad breath and it bothers you and you never tell me about it, how am I going to know that I have a problem? Also, we don't like to be told that we have a problem. So this is not, like, you know where I'm going. This is not about bad breath. This is about receiving feedback. And receiving feedback is a character issue. It's embarrassing, and sometimes it hurts to be told that we're doing something that is a problem. and we tend not to like it when someone gives us negative feedback. I say negative feedback, but constructive criticism is actually positive feedback if we have the right attitude about it. Our fault or weakness that someone points out to us may not be a character issue in itself, but how we respond to it is. Do we have enough character that we can handle it when someone at work is brave enough to show us where we can do something better, where we're not meeting expectations, where our behavior is causing a problem? Imagine you're a popular public speaker and crowds are coming to hear you speak, and someone has the audacity to pull you aside and tell you that your message is flawed. Maybe someone will do that to me today, I don't know. How would that feel? Well, we find that story in Acts 18. The speaker was a man named Apollos, and he was teaching only the baptism of John. And God used a husband and wife team named Aquila and Priscilla to expound to him so that he could preach and teach more accurately. All three of those people were team players. Aquila and Priscilla were willing to risk rejection by offering help to Apollos. And Apollos apparently didn't overreact or become discouraged. Instead, he took the correction to heart and continued speaking effectively, becoming more effective than ever. That is an example of character. Character is such a big deal because it affects so many things. Let's do a little thought experiment. We all know that fighting wars is expensive, not just in dollars and cents, but homes and communities are destroyed and people die. So instead of war, why don't nations find an easier way to settle disputes? And my suggestion is we could settle disputes with a chess game, and whoever wins the chess game wins, and let's just avoid this expensive, destructive war. It would be fast, easy, cheap. No one would die. Now, why wouldn't that work? Well, the losing side wouldn't accept the result. So there would be a fist fight between the two chess players. And then the onlookers would choose sides and start fighting. And then someone would run home and get a gun. And then each side would send reinforcements. And then you have a full-blown war. Why does it happen? Well, you know the answer. It's the human heart. It's carnality. Human nature tends toward escalation. In 1986 in Ukraine, a nuclear reactor that was producing electricity blew up, and toxic radiation spread for hundreds of miles and sickened and killed many people. The plant nearby where the workers lived had to be completely abandoned. You can see it in the foreground on you can see the city there in the foreground. It stands empty today. And soon after the accident, the Soviet Union built a concrete structure over the damaged reactor to contain the radiation. But over time, that concrete structure started to leak and collapse. And so more recently, this huge arched building was built over top of that with the goal of containing the radiation inside for 100 years. Interestingly enough, that structure has been damaged in the fighting in Ukraine. But that radiation from that reactor is a picture of the carnality inside of us, that it will leak out and infect our relationships. The Apostle Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, "For ye are yet carnal, for whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are you not carnal?" We can give many reasons for the relationship problems that we have. Things like, she just rubs me the wrong way, and he never understands me. But many of our struggles with our coworkers can be traced back to the heart. And heart-level problems require heart-level solutions. We all want to have good character. Here's a few ways that character shows up. Instead of ego, a person with character has humility. Instead of rudeness, they treat their coworkers with respect. Instead of overreacting, maturity. Instead of holding grudges, a team player shows forgiveness. Instead of fear, confidence. Instead of hiding mistakes, freely acknowledging and learning from our mistakes. Those are signs of character. Let's go on to the next element of a team player, followership. This is the vertical relationship with our boss, the ability to follow instructions and interact respectfully with our leadership, to be somebody that our boss can count on. Why is followership important? As team players, we need to be directed and coordinated to reach the goal. Otherwise, we're not a team, we're just a collection of people. And I want to start by thinking about the connotations of followership versus leadership. I'm sure some of you are familiar with the writings of John Maxwell, whose books on leadership have sold millions of copies. His website here claims that he is the number one leadership expert. Now, can you think of anyone who is claiming to be the number one followership expert? Why not? Well, we think of leaders as being confident and smart and important, and we look up to them, but who's looking up to a follower, right? And who's celebrating the follower? And who wants to be a followership expert? And because we tend to think of followers as the opposite of leaders, it's easy to think that followers are timid and helpless and unimportant, like sheep. But that's not true. For one thing, every leader is also a follower. We're all followers. Second, followers are the foundation of an organization. Let's look at an org chart. We might not say it out loud, but we subconsciously think of org charts like this as different levels of value and significance. And the higher up the org chart that you are, the more valuable you are and the more significant you are, and then vice versa. If you're low on the org chart, you don't have much value and significance. But that's not the way that it should be. The company cannot function without the bottom of the org chart. Frontline employees like you and me make it possible for the organization to succeed. As an employee, you have skills. You grow and develop. You're worth investing in. You have influence on people. You get the job done. You understand that leadership roles are important and necessary, but you also understand that your own followership role is necessary and valuable too. Followers are the foundation of a company. So I have three tips for doing followership well. I just picked three to share with you, and there's plenty more. Follow instructions, but also show initiative and ownership. You're not the owner of the company, but you can own your daily responsibilities. There's a quote: there are two kinds of men who never amount to much. Those who cannot do what they are told, and those who can do nothing else. So don't be either one of these kinds of people. This thing of taking initiative, though, it requires discretion. Think of your responsibilities as your property. You need to know where the boundaries of your property are, and don't cross the boundaries to your neighbors unless you have permission. Do you remember the story in the Bible of Absalom's rebellion against his father David? And during the battle that followed, a soldier found Absalom hanging by his head in a tree, and he went and told Joab, the general, and Joab said, "Why didn't you kill him? I would have paid you." And the soldier said, "I would not have hurt the king's son even for 1,000 pieces of silver, because all of us heard the king tell you not to hurt Absalom." So that soldier understood the concept of staying on your property. Joab didn't. He said, "I don't have time for you." And he went and killed Absalom, and David never forgot it. Joab crossed the line. The next tip for doing followership well is to ask your boss for relief when you can't complete your work. I know you're a very competent person, but you can't serve well if you're buried under a huge pile of work. Another quote: if not controlled, work will flow to the competent man until he submerges. And there are various reasons that this happens, some innocent and some not so innocent. Taking on too much responsibility can spring from a desire to be helpful, or it can spring from a desire to be important or to prove something. Either way, it's not productive to be overloaded. Your leader's job is to serve you, and one way they can do that is by making sure you have a manageable workload. But they need your cooperation in that. And then the third way that I have to do followership well is to be a low-maintenance employee. You don't like to operate high-maintenance machinery because it's frustrating and it constantly needs attention. So don't be that kind of employee. Another quote, these might be the person who exhausts their manager's time rather than extends it, or the person who makes a good point but requires a lot of words to do so. They are like a massive gas-guzzling Hummer. It will get you there, but it consumes a lot of resources in the process. If you're not sure whether you're low maintenance or high maintenance, just ask your boss if he has any suggestions for you to be more low maintenance. Wrapping up this section on followership, don't resist the label of follower or employee. We can embrace it and we can do good. We can become good at it. The third element of a team player is collaboration. So followership was about the vertical relationship between you and your boss. Collaboration now is about the horizontal relations, interactions with coworkers, the ability to go back and forth, give feedback, receive feedback. This is my definition. Collaboration is the process through which each member's contribution is harnessed and added to the team's collective effort and wisdom. Collaboration happens across all levels of the organization, both in formal settings like meetings and also just impromptu conversations on the job. We're going to look at collaboration through the lens of three sets of words here: candor and curiosity, independence and dependence, and then isolation and domination. And we'll start with candor and curiosity. Many of you are likely familiar with the space shuttle program. It's shut down now, but here's a picture of a space shuttle during launch. It's attached to a large fuel tank. That's the orange-colored object in the photo, and then the two rockets on each side, and the shuttle itself is like what's shaped as an airplane. It launches straight up like this, and then it lands on a runway like an airplane. What I want to tell you about is the launch of the space shuttle Columbia in 2003. During launch, a piece of icy foam broke off of the fuel tank, and it appeared to strike Columbia's left wing. The big question for NASA was, did the foam damage the shuttle when it hit the wing or not? And specifically what they were concerned about was, did it damage the heat protective tiles on the leading edges of the wing? So here's the picture of a space shuttle landing and the black tiles on the front edges of the shuttle and the shuttle's nose and wings. That's what protects it when it slams back into the atmosphere, the air surrounding the Earth after being in space. And the space shuttle becomes very hot as it re-enters the atmosphere. And if there was a hole in one of those tiles, the space shuttle would be lost because it would tear apart. There were seven astronauts on board the Columbia, and NASA told them while they were in space about the possible foam strike and told them, quote, "We have absolutely no concern for re-entry." But that wasn't true, because some individuals within NASA actually were highly concerned. And unfortunately, the protective tiles on the wing, on the left wing, were indeed damaged. And when Columbia came home, I don't know if you've ever been in a car and stuck your hand out the window while you're driving at high speed, and you can feel your hand being pulled backwards by the force of the air. Well, think about the shuttle coming in at thousands of miles per hour and hitting the blanket of air that surrounds the Earth, and you can understand the friction that's there and the heat that's generated. Well, when the Columbia came home, the hole in the wing, as it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, let hot gases inside, and the wing disintegrated, and the Columbia shuttle went tumbling through the air and broke up and burned. And there is a picture of that happening. There's seven astronauts dying there in that ball of fire. The debris field over Texas and Louisiana was 300 miles long. Of course, there was an investigation of what went wrong. And I'll give you two quotes from the report. This is in relation to the lower level engineers speaking up. The report said, the debris assessment team members opined that by raising contrary points of view about shuttle mission safety, they would be singled out for possible ridicule by their peers and managers. About NASA leadership, the report said, in fact, their management techniques unknowingly imposed barriers that kept at bay both engineering concerns and dissenting views, and ultimately helped create blind spots that prevented them from seeing the danger the foam strike posed. So NASA is a complex organization, and I know that we don't work for the government and we don't work in these huge complex organizations, but still, even in our small businesses, collaboration and communication is a real challenge. Being a team player requires the give and take of both speaking out and listening well. In his book, Conversational Capacity, Craig Weber says, we know we're communicating in an open, balanced, non-defensive way when there's balance between candor and curiosity. We don't mind sharing our ideas and perspectives, and we're equally interested in exploring the ideas and perspectives of others. So I'd like to zero in on those two words that he used, candor and curiosity. Candor means being transparent and forthright about what we think. Of course, this can be taken too far. You can hurt people, you can get in trouble if you're too unkind, aggressive, demeaning, or loud. Practicing candor is not as easy as just blurting out our opinion. We also need to be prepared to say why we think the way we do. Some conversations go like this, where Joe speaks up and he says, I don't think we should do that. And John says, why not? And Joe says, because I don't think it will work. Joe has spoken up with candor, but he has not articulated anything helpful yet because he hasn't explained his reasons for thinking why the proposed solution won't work. Joe needs to be able to think hard enough to be able to share his reasoning so that his underlying rationale can be examined by the rest of the team. Curiosity, then, is the other side of this coin. Curiosity, in this context, means seeking out the other person's point of view, being curious about what they think, drawing them out. We can ask, do you have an example of what you mean? Or what factors lead you to that conclusion? Or could you be more specific about why you think this way? Joe had said, I don't think it will work. So John now needs to practice curiosity. He could ask, what part of the plan do you think won't work? Or what problems do you think we'll run into? Speaking out with candor and listening with curiosity don't happen only once in a conversation. We cycle through them. We can practice candor by giving our opinion and then immediately practice curiosity by asking, what do you think? What does it look like from your perspective? What am I missing? Remember that our goal in a conversation is not to prove ourselves right, but the goal is to find a good solution, and it may or may not be what we first thought. The next pair of ideas that I want to look at is independence and dependence. This was the slogan of the U.S. Army for 20 years. It carries, be all you can be. It carries the idea that being in the Army will make you confident, skilled, and courageous. And then in 2001, the Army switched to this slogan, an army of one, and that slogan lasted only 5 years. When you stop and think about it, this second slogan, an army of one, is an odd slogan for an organization that requires subordination, teamwork, sacrifice, and unity. These slogans highlight, though, a paradox that the Army faces. It needs to appeal to the potential soldier's desire to be bold and independent. At the same time, armies can't function without teamwork, unity, and dependence on each other. So what does the U.S. Army really want, dependence or independence? Well, you and I face the same question. Our bosses and our coworkers We'll get tired of our questions and our need for input and affirmation if we can't work independently. But there's an extreme here that we need to avoid. Working so independently that we cut ourselves off from feedback and input doesn't work well either. That's a lone ranger who goes out on a limb by themselves. So we need a balance between independence and dependence. We need both. We need personal responsibility and we need teamwork. And that includes some level of dependence. We should be independent enough to be trustworthy, come up with helpful ideas on our own, and not hinder others in their work. And we should be dependent on others in ways that improves the quality of our work through others' assistance and input. We should be dependent enough to listen and independent enough to raise questions. Then the third set of ideas, of words that I want to look at, is isolation and domination. Let's look at isolation first. Have you ever had a wonderful idea that everyone rejected? It took some risk for you to stick your neck out and propose this idea, and then it wasn't accepted. Well, how do you feel? It kind of hurts when that happens. The temptation is to take that rejection personally and withdraw like a turtle. We disengage from the conversation and we don't give and take. Sometimes this takes the shape of just hunkering down silently, but other times it can take the shape of heading off in our own direction, doing things our own way by ourselves. Besides rejection, what are some other reasons that someone might isolate themselves at work? Well, perhaps the person sees themselves as superior to his coworkers and distances himself as a way of displaying his perceived superiority. Or perhaps the opposite is true. A person can isolate themselves because they feel inferior to their coworkers. Or they have tense relationships. Or they may have a victim mentality and blame other people for not understanding them. We can even have good reasons for isolating ourselves. And I put good in quotation marks there, because it takes too much time to get other people's input to make teamwork happen. I'm just going to go ahead on my own. It's quicker. Or we may think we have a good plan. I don't need any assistance. But isolation has a cost. It shuts off our opportunities to learn and grow. Other people on the team have good ideas, constructive criticism that would help us, but if we're isolated, we don't get access to that. It also removes opportunities for us to contribute to the rest of the team. I may have a good idea, but if I'm unwilling to offer it, the team will move on without my good idea. Another downside to remember about isolation is that if we're isolated and something goes wrong, then the blame is entirely our fault. The opposite of isolation then is domination. Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain during World War II, was a dominating person. Someone who worked with him described him this way: "It was not in his nature to allow anybody except himself to be the executive authority when any action of importance had to be taken. Even in matters of the most extreme technicality, he would insist on an elaborate presentation of his own views, and his powers of argument were so extraordinary that again and again, tired officials were hypnotized, I can think of no better word, into accepting opinions which differed vastly from those they normally held." So he would bulldoze his opponents into going along with him. Maybe you have a coworker like that. Sometimes we can come across too strong. Here are some ways that domination happens. Volume, being too loud, can really intimidate people. Or being too forceful, being too intense about what we believe. Speaking up too often. Rudeness, interrupting people. That's a way to dominate someone, is by interrupting them. Unkindness, derogatory remarks, sarcasm, shaming someone. And manipulation is a form of domination. Working behind the scenes to manipulate people toward the outcome that we want. When there's a dominating person on the team, some team members may be drawn to that person's confidence, but then there are others, even if they disagree with him, they won't speak up because they want to avoid the conflict. Both isolation and domination, the two extremes here, are taking a good thing too far. In the case of isolation, it's good to be quiet and listen to what others say. In the case of domination, it's good to be engaged, to care, to take action, but we can't trample all over other people. That's not collaboration. So collaboration is the solution here. It's a blend of confidence and humility. Collaboration requires confidence that says, take a look at my idea. I think this might work, but also humbly says, what do you think will work? What am I missing? I like to think of, to typify collaboration with two people in a canoe. They sit in different seats and have different perspectives, but they're working together, not against each other. They're actually rowing on opposite sides, right? And so their teamwork of being on opposite sides helps the canoe move forward in the direction that they want to go. So we and our coworkers, we should not be working against each other, but we need to be working towards the goal. Yes, there's friction and leverage in canoeing, but that friction and leverage is not directed against the other person. It's to move forward. It's productive friction. The fourth element then of being a team player is competence. We've talked about character, followership, and collaboration. And then the last one is competence. We need to be able to get the job done and do it well. I'm going to talk about two different kinds of competence. This is a picture of Jackie Robinson. He was the first black player in the Major League Baseball. Up until 1947, no black players had been allowed in the league. And I had known about Jackie since I was a boy, but I didn't know that he was chosen for this role. The manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers went looking for a black ball player who could be the first ball player in the major leagues. And he wanted not just a great player, but also one that could handle the hatred and harassment that he would get from his fellow players and the spectators. And there's a story about the manager interviewing Jackie, and the manager said, I know you're a good ball player, but I don't know whether you have the guts. And Jackie Robinson didn't understand what he meant. And Ricky clarified, I'm looking for a ball player with guts enough not to fight back. He actually quoted the Sermon on the Mount to Robinson. So as team players, we need to have two kinds of competence. One is technical competence, which, can we get the job done? Do we know how to operate the equipment? The second one, though, is relational competence. Can you get along with people? You can have great technical competence, but if you can't get along with your coworkers, it's going to be a problem for you. Think about Jesus. He had technical competence. He was a carpenter and knew how to build things, but he had great relational competence as well. So how can we grow our relational competence? I like to make an analogy with the Wright brothers and all their fellow inventors who were trying to figure out how to fly 100 years ago. Wilbur Wright made this great observation in a speech. If I take this piece of paper and after placing it parallel with the ground, quickly let it fall, it will not settle steadily down as a staid, sensible piece of paper ought to do, but it insists on contravening every recognized rule of decorum, turning over and darting hither and thither in the most erratic manner, much after the style of an untrained horse. So I have a piece of paper here, and let's drop it. And you can see what he was talking about, that that a piece of paper doesn't act in an organized manner, but it's very erratic. He goes on to finish the quote, "Yet this is the style of steed that men must learn to manage before flying can become an everyday sport. The bird has learned this art of equilibrium and has learned it so thoroughly that its skill is not apparent to our sight. We only learn to appreciate it when we try to imitate it." God created the universe and the laws that govern flight. So to learn to fly, people needed to discover the laws of aerodynamics and physics and then go with the flow of those principles and not violate them. When a plane violates God's laws, it crashes. And when we violate the laws of interacting with people that God created, we will crash too. As we grow in understanding God's ways and gain experience in applying God's principles to our relationships, we can grow more relationally competent. So let's look at the relational competence triangle, and we'll start at the bottom. Relational competence is based on understanding how God's ways work. Love your enemies. A soft answer turns away wrath. God in the Bible reveals principles to us for how things work in his world. The law of sowing and reaping. These are like the law of gravity. We can't change it. We need to learn to go along with it. And this is the basis of our relational competence. Then moving more from more broad to more specific, we need to remember how human nature works. The self-awareness of knowing that without intervention, my carnal nature will drive me to respond in certain ways in certain situations. And the same is true for my coworkers. Even as Christians, we have to wrestle with our carnal nature. More specific yet, we need to understand our workplace culture. In your workplace, is it okay to drop by offices impromptu to talk, or is it preferred you schedule a time in advance to meet? What are the attitudes in your workplace towards deadlines? Are important issues addressed in your workplace, or are they swept under the rug? Those are simple examples of culture. Understanding your workplace structure, how the org chart works, is also part of this. And then lastly, understanding specific people. Observe your coworkers' personalities, their strengths and weaknesses, and then relate to them accordingly. How do they like to communicate? Are they a big picture person or a detail person? What are they sensitive about? What are they good at? And what are they embarrassed about because they're not as good at? If you understand these categories, observe the people around you, and then let it influence how you operate at work, you can really grow in your relational competence. Years ago, I read this quote from astronaut Frank Borman. He said, "Superior pilots use their superior judgment to stay out of situations requiring them to demonstrate their superior skill." Superior pilots use their superior judgment to stay out of situations requiring them to demonstrate their superior skill. And that really struck me. I never forgot it. But before I passed it along to you, I wanted to know if that was a valid statement or not. So I asked my friend, who's a professional pilot, if this quote resonated with him. And he said, "Yes, it does. Learning and skill is part of the profession of flying, but knowing how to mitigate risk and avoid bad situations is a superior skill. This has relevance to life in general," he said. "This has relevance to life in general." So that's what I'm getting at. Can you become competent in your job getting along with people, flying through life? Use your superior judgment as you become more mature and as you become better at relating people to stay out of situations where you will be prone to crash. Of course, we need God's grace to do that. But my vision of relational competence for you is that you and I can learn to fly skillfully and avoid causing relational crashes. Let's review the four elements as a team player. Consider yourself. How is your character? Are you a top-notch follower? Are you an elite follower? How well do you engage in back and forth, giving feedback, receiving feedback, asking questions, changing your mind, collaborating with your coworkers? How well do you do that? How deep is your relational competence? Perfection in this life, on this earth, isn't possible. At your job, with your coworkers, there's always going to be challenges. Like, you'll never reach the place where it's the perfect environment and you always get along perfectly. Sometimes you will fail to be what you should be. And sometimes your coworkers will fail to be what they should be. So perfection isn't possible. That's not what we're going for here. But peace and productivity are possible. Peace inside of us, peace with those around us, and the result is productivity. God designed us humans to be team players, so it not only brings us joy, but also brings him joy when we use the talents that he gave us, follow the principles of relationships that he designed, and do the work that he's given us to do. Then he's blessed, we are blessed, the company that we work for is blessed, and the people we serve are blessed too. God bless all of you. Thank you.